Welcome to In Conversation with writer and editor Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life, a monthly chat with writers, publishers, and those who support the literary arts. Today, she is talking with poet Holly Hughes about her work as a poet, her teaching, and the anthology she created.
Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you're listening to the program In Conversation with Sheila Bender, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have Holly J. Hughes in the studio with us. She is the author of Sailing by Ravens from the University of Alaska Press, 2014, co-author of The Pen and the Bell, Mindful Writing in a Busy World from Skinner House Press in 2012. She's the editor of the award-winning anthology Beyond Forgetting, Poetry and Prose about Alzheimer's Disease, which came from Kent State University Press in 2009, and she's the author of Boxing the Compass from Floating Bridge Press, 2007. About her collection of poems Sailing by Ravens, former Alaska Writer Laureate Nancy Lord writes, Holly Hughes has found all her compass points in mapping this world with great intelligence, compassion, and meaning. She is a graduate of the Rainier Writing Workshop MFA program at Pacific Lutheran University and a recipient of a Washington State Artist Trust Fellowship and residencies at Hedgebrook, Centrum, and the Vermont Studio Center. She teaches writing at Edmonds Community College, where she directs the Convergence Writers Series and received the Excellence in Education Award in 2012. She has spent over 30 summers working on the water in Alaska in a variety of roles, including commercial fishing for salmon, skippering a 65-foot schooner, and more recently, working as a naturalist on ships. Welcome, Holly. It's nice to have you today in the studio.
Thank you, Sheila. It's a pleasure to be here.
Reading your bio once again, I can see how your work in Alaska has influenced your poetry collections and your subject matter. And I wonder if we might start just by hearing a little bit about that. Did you write before you went to Alaska? Did you begin writing during and after? How does that all work for you?
It's a good question. I've always loved writing. I've always used writing as a way to sort of process what was going on in my life. And during my years of fishing, there was a lot of time where we would just be hanging out and I had time to write. So my fishing journals are, you know, a couple inches thick. So I was doing a lot of writing during that time. And it also was a great opportunity to really establish a daily practice of writing, partly because I needed that. I needed that way to check in. It really kind of grounded me, if you could be grounded at sea.
That's a good point. Why did you go to the waters of Alaska? What brought you there?
Oh, it's a complicated story. I graduated from college and I wanted adventure, and I'd always been in love, been intrigued by Alaska. And I went up to make money for graduate school. I went up and worked in a cannery, and at the end of the summer, my college sweetheart and I, we'd gone up together. We ended up buying a fishing boat and deciding to fish instead of going back to graduate school, to the surprise and chagrin of our parents, of course.
Absolutely. So you had a lot of adventures on the water.
We did.
How did that directly influence, do you think, your writing poetry? Did you comb the journals or just had that practice and were able to incorporate navigation and mapping and fish and birds into your work?
Well, I think just the interest in navigation, that really became a theme in writing poems. I mean, I write poems about other things too, but in working with those years, I love maps, I love navigation, and I love the metaphors inherent in both of them. And so some of it was going back to journals. In fact, I can read you a poem that really came right out of my fishing log. And then others was doing some research, it gave me a great excuse to do some reading.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is called What the Sea Takes Gives Back. And it comes out of our gill netting days. We were gill netting for salmon. And I would literally keep a log of what we caught. What the sea takes gives back. One day's catch recorded in the log. 40 sockeye, 15 chums, 7 cohos, a white king. A receipt book, yellow pages thick as an accordion. A plastic Joy soap bottle, 1 tennis shoe left, its tongue swollen. What we keep, what we toss. The day I dropped the fish pick overboard, watched it sink out of sight. Next set, fetched up by the net. The night the storm petrel skittered down on deck, rode with us across the gulf, then flew. What the sea takes, gives back. The fisherman, gone overboard, found the next morning, boat adrift, tangled in his net.
Oh, Holly, I have chills listening to that.
Thank you, Sheila.
You certainly took me to those waters and to a life there and all that you see. How long has it been since you had that life, since you were fishing in Alaska?
It's been decades since I've been fishing. I continue, as you mentioned, I continue to go up to Alaska every season. I would miss it too much if I didn't. I mean, it really does get in your blood. More recently, I've been working as a naturalist, on ships, which I've been enjoying a lot. And this past summer, I went up and taught at the Ketchumek Bay Writers Conference and then gave a workshop, a Penn and Bell workshop, in a beautiful place called Halibut Cove. So I've been doing different things over the years, but I'm hooked on Alaska.
Pun intended. Well, you brought up the title again, the Pen and the Bell, and giving a Pen and the Bell workshop. I know the work in that book is an outgrowth of your work logging and making deep observations and having that time to think that you experienced decades ago and kept up, it sounds like. Can you tell us about that book and the work you do from it?
Sure. Oh, it was such a wonderful collaboration with the writer Brenda Miller, who I know you know as well, wonderful writer. And we really enjoyed putting it together. It began in a fairly organic way in that we were both struggling with how to make time in our own lives for our own writing. We're both teachers of writing. We both serendipitously had a sabbatical at the same fall. And so we started writing letters back and forth to each other about this issue. And as it happened, the letters really became the book as we wrestled with, you know, how to do this. And then, of course, we shaped it and got to go away on retreat together to wonderful places like Hedgebrook. And it eventually came together into its current form. And we include both contemplative practice and writing practice exercises. And I should say, too, that's really what brought Brenda and I together, is that we both share a contemplative practice and feel strongly that it helps inform and shape our writing practice, that the two practices really reinforce each other.
So when you give the workshops, it includes some meditation or contemplation?
It does. It does. You know, it's not, we're not formal teachers of meditation, but we do some very easy mindfulness practice, just following your breathing. We do some movement practice, stretching, just things to kind of bring us back into our bodies, because in our fast-paced lives, it's so easy to become separate. And so the mindfulness practice, it could be as simple as breathing three times when you're stopped at a red light, you know, things like that. I had the great privilege of studying with the Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. That's who I'm drawing my basis of mindfulness practice from. One of the things I really appreciate about Thich Nhat Hanh is that he recognizes that we can't all go away on retreat.
Absolutely.
And that it's useful, it's very helpful to try to find ways to incorporate mindfulness into our everyday lives. And so when I was at Deer Park Monastery in California, when he was there, every hour a bell would ring and you would stop what you were doing and just close your eyes and breathe until the ringing stopped. And it was just such a good reminder. I think there's so many bells ringing that we can take advantage of, even though we don't. Sometimes I wish I did have that bell ringing every hour just to remind me. But there are other ways that we can do that. Sometimes a ringing telephone, you know, right, can be a bell.
Tell me how that's connected to writing, how you teach people the connection between being in your body, reminded to slow down and be there, and what it takes to write.
Oftentimes what I've found, for years I've been doing what Julia Cameron calls morning pages, you know, and I find that I sort of stumbled upon putting the two practices together one year at Hedgebrook. It was my first time there. I had just come from a meditation retreat, and I was feeling very daunted and overwhelmed by the other women there, and I ended up getting up in the morning and experiencing writer's block for the first time. You know, I thought, oh, finally, I'm at Hedgebrook. I want to write. And then
which, by the way, is a very local, wonderful retreat on Whidbey Island.
Yes, yes. And so I did what I knew how to do. I just come from a meditation retreat, so I got my cushion and went to the window and sat. And then I went to my desk, and I wrote about what I saw outside my window. And I just used that as a starting point. But it just settled me. Sometimes I find when I do that, I continue to do that. I find that an image will perhaps surface that I wasn't aware of, or an emotion. I'll get in touch with an emotion I've been suppressing. So the combination, I think, of mindfulness is that you can move more quickly to those more authentic emotions. You don't have to go through, as Stanley Kunitz, the wonderful poet, said, you know, live in the layers, mm-hmm. not in the litter. And I think for me, mindfulness allows me to move deeper into the layers. And our lives are full of so much litter, it's easy to be there instead.
So it sounds like being in your body helps be in your writing.
That's right. I believe that's true for me.
Excellent advice, I think.
Yeah.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 Port Townsend. In case you've just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, she is talking with poet Holly Hughes about her work as a poet, her teaching, and the anthology she created.
So you've put out another book that's very helpful to people. This one is helpful to people who need reminders about how to be one with their writing. And you edited an anthology on poetry and prose about Alzheimer's disease. And I've been very moved by the work in that book. And I wonder where that came from in you to put that book together and how it's connecting with people.
It came from a very real situation in my own life, which is that I lost my mother to Alzheimer's disease. And she died in 2001, so this was a while ago. And during that time, I looked for poems. I looked for books. I mean, there were books, how-to books, but I didn't find any books of poetry. And that's what I turn to when I'm needing solace. And at the same time, I was in an MFA program, the Rainier Writing Workshop, which required an outside project. And so it really, the seed for this book was planted right here in Port Townsend. I had lunch with the directors, Stan Rubin and Judith Kitchen, and I told them about my idea. And Judith said, you should do that. And so I leapt in, and not realizing how much work it would be, and I think had I known, I might not have attempted it. But now that it's done, I'm really glad I did. I put out a call for submissions just to sort of test the waters and received over 500 submissions in a couple months' time. So there was plenty of good material to work with.
How many did you accept for the book?
I forget the exact number, but there are 100 different writers represented. A few of them have more than one poem. Yeah.
Excellent. And so you received the solace you needed by reading the submissions.
I did. And I was teaching full-time and in graduate school, and I was often reading the submissions at 1 in the morning, and that's really when I did my grieving. Yeah. Mm.
That's a really tender story.
Yeah.
So the book helped you, first of all, and now it's out there in the world, and I know it's offering solace to others. Have you heard from any of your readers?
I do. I still do. Even though it's been out, it's thankfully in its third printing, and thankfully Kent State is keeping it in print. I'm very grateful for that. It seems to have a life of its own. It seems like every couple months I'll get an email from somebody on the website that just says thank you. I really needed this. And I think one of the things that's so helpful about it is that when you're caregiving somebody with Alzheimer's, oftentimes you can't leave the house. And so with this book, you have the company of 100 different poets who've been down this road and know it. And I included a little bit of information at the bottom of each page about the person, so that my hope is that people feel less alone. There's kind of a fun story, just in terms of never knowing where your poems are going to go when they go out into the world. And I wrote a poem about giving my mother a bath, which has been published in a few different magazines and anthologies now. And a friend of mine who's a filmmaker, Fidalgo Films, really loves this poem and ended up making a short feature film based upon it, also called The Bath. And his mother also has Alzheimer's. And so his film is really a combination of my experience and his experience. And it's a beautifully made film. It's winning awards at film festivals. If you Google Fidalgo Films and The Bath, you can see the trailer.
Excellent.
From it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear the poem.
Okay. The Bath. The tub fills inch by inch as I kneel beside it, trail my fingers in the bright braid of water. Mom perches on the toilet seat, entranced by the ritual until she realizes the bath's for her. Oh, no, she says, drawing her three layers of shirts to her chest, crossing her arms and legs. Oh, no, I couldn't, she repeats, brow furrowing, that look I now recognize like an approaching squall. I abandon reason, the hygiene argument, promise a Hershey's bar if she will just please take off her clothes. Oh, no, she repeats, her voice rising. Meanwhile, the water is cooling. I strip off my clothes, step into it, let the warm water take me completely, slipping down until only my face shines up, a moon mask. Mom stays with me, interested now in this turn of events. I sit up. Will you wash my back, Mom? So much gone, but let this still be there. She bends over to dip the washcloth in the still warm water, squeezes it, lets it dribble down my back, leans over to rub the butter pad of soap, swiping each armpit, then rinses off the suds with long practice strokes. I turn around to thank her, catch her smiling, lips pursed, humming, still a mother with a daughter whose back needs washing.
Holly, I can barely speak. It's beautiful.
Thank you, Sheila. It's taken me years to be able to read it without weeping.
Well, we'll be in tears together here. I'll erase all those tears. It's just beautiful.
Thank you.
Of course, I heard the word squall, approaching squall in there. Very influenced by your time on the boat.
Right, that's right.
Your time living in an area of the world where squalls come up. And it made me realize that in The Pen and the Bell, when you're talking about mindfulness, you also talk about your time on the water.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an excerpt you'd like to read from that?
Sure. This is in the chapter. It's actually the very first chapter of the book called Sitting Down and Waking Up. Maybe I'll read the epigraph because it's Sam Green, a poet I greatly admire and have been influenced by, and it's from his book called The Grace of Necessity. Except for paying attention, what else is continual prayer? So Brenda and I are each writing about paying attention, and so this is my part in my response to Brenda's letter. Paying attention became a practice for me when I fished commercially for 8 years in Alaska. While fishing was the hardest physical work I've done, there were also long stretches of time for contemplation. Sailing north in the spring when the days were long and we could run 20 hours. Or after we'd set the green dripping gillnet off the stern of our 33-foot boat and waited for it to fill with silver salmon. The time between bursts of activity was filled with reading, writing, and navigating, which I later came to understand as my own version of mindfulness practice. I loved the way fishing grounded me firmly in the moment with whatever needed attention. 20 sleek king salmon waiting to be cleaned, a storm gathering, a 10-hour run back to town through the red and green lights of Wrangell Narrows. We needed to pay attention to the way the wind veered out of the southwest and picked up to 40 knots. We needed to pay attention to the odd clatter in the diesel engine when we ran it at 600 RPMs. I needed to pay attention to my body, my stomach turning queasy as we rounded the cape and headed out into open waters.
Thank you. A lesson in there for me is maybe writing our way through the litter by naming the litter. I know this isn't litter. Mm-hmm. This is definitely life-preserving. Mm-hmm. But sometimes just approaching the litter as if it's something to observe can help. And I think as writers, we kind of, especially when we sit down to draft, we should be open to writing about whatever it is we need to write about. Maybe that's what the morning pages are partly doing. Somebody said to me recently this week, she said, you were driving in town and I was driving the other way and I kept waving at you and you didn't see me. And she said, should you be driving? And I said, believe me, I see the cars, but I didn't necessarily see that it was you. My mind was on my to-do list.
Uh-huh.
And I think maybe each of us should write some litter work and see what happens, if we can wade our way through it to something more beautiful.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I had wanted to come back to the morning pages. That what I often found was that I'd write three pages, and it was at the end of the third page that I'd really get to a little seed or kernel of something I wanted to explore.
How do you notice that?
I mean, I actually feel it in my body. I feel an energy coming. You know, some of it just like, oh, today, the kind of the stuff that we all go through, and it's only when I get down to something that surprises me, I guess, that's where I feel like, and I can feel my energy pick up, that's where I feel like I'm on to something.
And then what happens?
Well, if I have time, I get a new piece of paper and start with that. If I don't have time, in my journal, I'll mark it to come back to it and come back to it later.
That's good. Do you think it takes practice for a writer to notice the thing you're saying you notice, which is that's where you're interested, that's where the energy is? Do you think people overlook their subject?
Probably. I mean, as a teacher, you know, I worked with students that are so close to what they're writing about, they don't realize how amazing it is. They don't realize that not everybody has had this experience, whether they're writing about something really difficult or something they're excited about. But I think that's oftentimes one of the biggest lessons we have to learn as writers.
Yeah. Can you say it succinctly? Or even with many words? What that lesson is? Because I agree with you, it's a crucial lesson.
I think just knowing when you're in... Annie Dillard has this metaphor in her book on writing about following the line of ore. And I think, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to get to that line. And then once we get it, we need to recognize it's... I think it has to do with trusting our intuition and abandoning what we think we should be writing about and instead writing about what's meaningful to us personally, individually. I think that trusting ourselves, it can be a hard lesson to learn.
And well said. And that trusting that feeling inside that, yeah, this interests me. This is something I want to explore.
Yeah.
No matter who thinks it wouldn't be important. Whoever's sitting on my shoulder telling me I had to do something else. I'm thinking of the poet Richard Hugo in his book Triggering Towns. You probably know this too. Mm-hmm. Says something about the poet being the truest cynic, meaning that no one thing is any more important or less important than anything else. So if the image of a spoon comes into your writing, it's just as important as the Atlantic Ocean. That we're not to judge the importance of the imagery and to accept what arrives. And that's a hard lesson for anyone who's been through school, where we've definitely been taught some things are more important than other things.
Well, and again, I think as a teacher, one of the things I try the hardest to teach is students often want to write about big abstract ideas, love, of course, death. I mean, all the things that make us human that we wrestle with each day, but that are only really... can be revealed in concrete details and specific examples. And I have to keep reminding them of that. God is in the details. The poem is in the details.
Right, and William Carlos Williams saying there is no intelligence but in things.
In things, exactly. Yeah.
Such a hard lesson. But as you said, if you come to your senses and take in through your senses, half the battle. What are some other teaching challenges?
Yeah, I teach at a community college, Edmonds Community College, but I also teach at local conferences. With my community college students, I think a challenge is that I find students aren't reading as much as they were when I started teaching 20 years ago, and that one of the things I try to do in my poetry classes is, of course, encourage them to read a lot of poetry. So that's a little bit of a challenge, but it's so rewarding, and I love getting to know my students through their poems, and many of them have challenging lives, and I think poetry really does become a wonderful outlet for them, and I'm gratified when I can see that happening.
They probably have told you that they were surprised by what they wrote and how important it was to them. Because once that happens, you can't go back.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're
a friend of poetry forever. Whether you continue to write past that class, if you're the student or not, you're still a friend to poetry. I know that you've been through the Rainier Writers Workshop, and you mentioned it earlier. And it sounds to me like you were writing as a poet before you went to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk a little bit about what your choice was, why to go to school, and how that's influenced your career?
That's a great question, Sheila. I was writing, but when you're teaching writing full time, it was just squeezed in around the edges when I got everything else done, which of course never happened. Or I'd get up really early, or I'd ride on the ferry. I'd just, you know, squeeze it in when I could. And I turned 50, and I realized I didn't have forever to finish some of these writing projects that I wanted to complete. And I needed the deadlines of a writing program, and it certainly gave me that. And it also allowed me to start prioritizing my writing, to make time for it, even in the middle of a busy teaching day. And that's really why Brenda and I wrote The Pen and the Bell, too. So it gave me that, and I think the thing it gave me that I didn't expect, but I'm so grateful for, is a sense of a writing community, other writers who I met in the program, both faculty and students, who I continue to be in close touch with, share work, celebrate joys, celebrate frustrations. So that's been a wonderful gift that program has given me, as well as the very concrete deadlines. And I think I just want to thank both Stan and Judith for putting together a really thoughtful program that recognized that many of their students are adults and have full working lives, and really tried to design a program that would meet their needs. And in my case, it certainly did. And also putting together a really terrific faculty, too.
And so Sailing by Ravens, your newest poetry collection, came out during or after you were in graduate school?
It was my thesis, actually. The chapbook that was published by Floating Bridge Press, Boxing the Compass, was my graduate thesis. And then I continued to work on poems, writing more, so that this is a full-length collection.
So it encompasses some of the poems from...
From Boxing the Compass.
Wonderful. Yeah. That's wonderful to know.
Yeah.
So as people want to check into your work further, tell us a website they can consult.
Oh, thank you for asking. My website is hollyjhughes.com, my name.com. And then you can also go to the Pen and Bell website, which is just penandbell.com. And there's a website for Beyond Forgetting. But if you go to my website, you'll find a link to all the other websites as well.
Excellent. So, and I imagine that you post your upcoming workshops. And
I do.
Good.
I do.
And so people can stay up to date and catch you when you're in town, or if they're in one of the towns or states that you're in. Anything else you'd like to tell us before we close our interview today?
Well, I guess just since we're in Port Townsend doing this interview, I'm just so grateful to live in this community, speaking of writing communities, where there are so many wonderful writers whom I admire, Tom Jay, Tim McNulty, Adrienne Harun, Peter and Anna Quinn, who are doing wonderful things with the Writers' Workshop and the Imprint Bookstore. And then, of course, you, Sheila, as well, with Writing at Real. So it's a wonderful community to be a part of, and I'm grateful for the chance to have this interview with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer. Announcer is Kurt Vanderslice.